The Playlist with Ben and Fiona.
Oh, this is going to be a gaff.
Welcome to The Playlist, where we talk about movies and TV shows that are worth your time. I'm Fiona Williams, and I manage our online coverage of movies and TV here at SBS, and I'm joined by my co-host, SBS and SBS Vice Slang Channel Manager, Ben Nguyen. Hey Ben, how's it going?
Hey Fee, I'm good. I was sorry to miss out on your close and personal chat with Mads Mikkelsen last week.
Yeah, that was a good one, and sorry I did keep that interview to myself. good to be in the Zoom room with friend of the show, Mads. And yes, possible awards contender, Mads. We'll get to that.
Yes, well, we will get to that, because with Oscar nominations around the corner, this week we're taking a look at awards season as it hits full swing, including the recent Golden Globes, and with a royal sit-down interview breaking the internet and the tabloids. We look at what the recent trend of celeb exposés says about our fascination with fame. And in What Have You Been Watching, we dissect the latest Marvel Cinematic Universe foray into the small screen in what is very much a celebration of the small screen in WandaVision.
Yeah, lots to get through. Let's get into it.
So I guess awards season kind of kicks off, I guess, maybe with the sort of Critics Circles Awards towards the end of last year, and it's been delayed this year because of COVID. But when it really starts to fire up is when we get these televised awards, and generally the big first one off the ranks is the Golden Globes, which went out last week. Mm. Let's hear a little bit of Tina Fey and Amy Poehler's opening monologue just to take us back.
And we'll be honoring all the fantastic TV shows you binge-watched this year. The American Office, Old Columbos, very one-sided news programs,
the Zoom town halls about your school staying closed, and of course, the cranberry juice skateboard guy. He's gonna skateboard to all the nominated songs tonight. How exciting.
Now, normally this room is full of celebrities, but tonight our audience on both coasts is made up of smoking hot first responders and essential workers.
Sophie, this event, it's run by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, made up of a bunch of LA-based international entertainment reporters, but every year, you know, they're not strangers to controversy. Every year we hear about their lack of credibility, questions why they have so much influence. The big story this year was highlighting the fact that there were no black journalists as part of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. What's your feeling about all of that?
Well, like you say, like this is not news that the Hollywood Foreign Press is a controversial outfit. There's maybe 90 members. I think at last count it was 87. And yeah, it's like it is the butt of a lot of jokes that it's this secretive cabal, that word is always used. You can buy nominations, basically have a nice junket and you'll put journalists up at five-star hotels and have a fantastic trip and a party and you might wind up with a nomination. So like that's kind of always been the joke, and the hosts at the Golden Globes tend to make those jokes, like we like Tina and Amy and Ricky Gervais before them. And I remember years ago there was a documentary on SBS, in fact, about trying to peek inside the Hollywood Foreign Press. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me that there are no black members. Their diversity levels are not great. They are international journalists, but they're courted by studios. Some of them are on the payroll of studios. It's a shambles, but the event is always seen as very influential to Oscars. And this year, unfortunately, because of all the timing and because of other awards have put their dates back, the Oscars occur in April. But just as we speak, Oscar voting in terms of what's going to be nominated, so the nomination voting, has just closed. So the only big awards that have happened are the Golden Globes. So like this year, more than most, ironically, when Hollywood Foreign Press is really in the news again for being such a dodgy outfit, they might actually have more influence than in other years, where you would have had the Screen Actors Guild or the Independent Spirits, and a lot of the Guild Awards would have taken place, but they haven't yet. So it's weird.
yeah. And I think the Globes tend to go with whatever's the buzziest sort of shows and movies out there. And I think that's the other big thing about the Globes is it's not just film, it's also television.
Correct, yep.
But, and I think that can have good and bad sides, this kind of just going for whatever the hot property is and trying to sort of jump on the opportunity to have kind of the exciting figure of the day up on stage. But this production of The Globes, obviously another COVID-affected production. So we had Amy Poehler and Tina Fey presenting from two different cities, one in New York, one in LA. A lot of use of split screen, a lot of jokes about split screen. First off, just as a television show, how did you take it?
I spend a lot of my day on Zoom calls, as do you. We're often on the same Zoom calls. And I appreciated that the celebs were, a large portion of them were on their own Zoom calls as well. Yeah. You know, some of them were on mute. It was like this. It was that kind of chaos of the working from home experience that was in the live show, which I appreciated. It was quite fun. They did what they had to do. I thought it was, for even though I think the awards are ridiculous, there has to be something better than Golden Globes to have the kind of status. But it was a good show. I mean, I criticised them, but of course I watched it start to finish and then caught a little bit on the repeat too. So, yeah, call me hypocrite, that's fine. But
yeah, you're right. That sort of all the kind of practicalities of Zoom and all the associated challenges with that, replacing what the Golden Globes is famous for, which is a lot of actors drinking consistently through the night and therefore being a bit looser on stage than what we might see at some other awards.
Yeah, true.
But I have to say, as a television event, a bit like the Emmys last year, which were in a similar format, I felt like it actually worked fairly well and was fairly tight as an awards show. To me, something that I feel very grateful that we're saved is those long treks up from the back of theatres. So obviously, yeah, we don't need to see that anymore. And I thought there were some cute touches, which was going out into ad breaks and, you know, sometimes some quite forced banter between the nominees as they sort of wait to find out the award results. That was a bit fun.
Yeah, yeah. Like we're in that sort of waiting room area of Zoom where we've been sometimes that, yeah, they were just having a bit of chat for the sake of a break. And yeah, at first I thought that might've been a mistake, but it was kind of, okay, let's have some fun. We're about to go on. But you say, you know, we're spared the long trek to the stage, but I like that because then you see the reaction shots and you see who's not clapping or, you know, I love that kind of inside baseball stuff too. So sadly, Zoom era, you don't get to see who else is watching on.
But we should get into the winners and maybe some of the losers as well. So, I mean, the first award for the night was Supporting Actor, and that went to Daniel Kaluuya for a film that you recently watched, Judas and the Black Messiah.
Yeah, that's true. That is just opened in Australia this week, actually, as we speak. Yes, he plays Fred Hampton, Black Panther leader, infamously killed by FBI and Chicago police. And look, he is great. The film was not for me. I was really disappointed in it, to be honest, because I thought it was going to be quite a great Fred Hampton story, but he's a sideline character in this story. Lakeith Stanfield plays Bill O'Neill, an FBI informant, you know, the Judas in the title. And it's kind of how he infiltrated and, you know, one of Fred Hampton's confidants. But that's a good way in, but yeah, the film is a little bit messy and you never really get an insight into either of the characters. Yeah, I just really wanted a really good story about this incredible time in the US, and it's another film where it shows the real people at the end and at the start, actually, through documentary footage, and that's so much more interesting and it's so much more energized. And I don't think it's Daniel Kaluuya's fault. He brings charisma to the role of Fred Hampton, but I was disappointed in the film. But congratulations to him for his Golden Globe Award.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because a number of the films this year dealt with dramatising real-life characters and stories from relatively recent history. So we had the Screenplay Award went to Aaron Sorkin for The Trial of Chicago 7, a film that you're not greatly endeared to. No. But we also had One Night in Miami nominated for a number of awards.
A film I absolutely love, and I will keep going into bat for that. I love it. It's available on Amazon here. Yeah, and it didn't have any love, but I really hope that it figures in the Oscar nominations coming up. I think it's a beautiful film that, yeah, it's not getting as much traction as it really should.
And we should point out that after notably Natalie Portman a few years ago up on stage made the point about the all-male director nominees at the Golden Globes, we had three women out of five nominees this time. One of them, being Chloe Zhao, who won for Nomadland.
Yeah.
But it would be nice to think that that signals a permanent shift.
I mean, wouldn't it? Yeah. But I don't know about Oscar. I hope those three carry over into the director's field because they're great films, all three. They're One Night in Miami, Regina King, Emerald Fennell for Promising Young Woman, and Chloe Zhao for Nomadland. And the film at least is the hot favourite. I hope she is. But Mank, for some reason, is getting a whole lot of attention. David Fincher directed about that. Hollywood loves movies about movies. And, of course, that's about the writing of Citizen Kane. And old mate Aaron Sorkin keeps getting in there as potential director nominee. But, I also hope Lee Isaac Chung, friend of the show, director of Minari, I hope he gets in there as well. We can only hope.
Yeah, and we did see him win for Best Foreign Language Film and
yes.
give a very...
Which was outrageous that it was nominated in that category. But.
Yes, yeah. I think a lot of the Twitter reaction was around that point. But he did give a very sweet acceptance speech with his daughter on his lap, who was talking about how much she'd prayed for that result. And I think that, again, this is sort of one of the benefits of a Zoom award ceremony is the children, loved ones and pets on screen.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's true. It's an at-home-with vibe to the whole thing. That was gorgeous, having his daughter there, because, of course, the film is about his family. It's about her grandparents and him and her aunt and everything. So, that was gorgeous, being a family moment to win for such a film about the family. Jodie Foster and her dog and her wife, they were in the pyjamas. That was excellent. In contrast to other nominees and winners in full haute couture dresses, sitting
still,
on a Zoom call, that was
room.
Weird.
Yeah.
I loved it. Totally. I loved it, but it was weird.
I like to pretend that that's me in my living room, just, you know, sort of during lockdown. I'm all about the couture.
Yeah. I'm not sitting here in a hoodie. I'm in haute couture right now. No one knows.
That's what I'm wearing now, dear listeners. Obviously, sort of another factor of the Globes is that they split out the dramatic categories with comedy musicals. So we mentioned Nomadland. Borat was the other big winner for on the comedy side. And so we had Sacha Baron Cohen accepting those awards from, I believe, his Sydney living room, where I think he's located at the moment.
Oh, okay. I mean, that doesn't surprise me. So many people are here at the moment. Idris Elba is allegedly down the road from me at the moment. But I haven't seen him at the shops. I'm looking.
And a very meaningful, I felt, acceptance speech was for Best Actor in a Movie Drama, which went to Chadwick Boseman and was accepted by his wife, who gave a very tearful acceptance speech. And that's where I think the reaction shots, you know, came into their own, because I don't think there was a dry eye in the house, let's face it.
Yeah. No, it was gorgeous. I mean, you know, we only lost him very recently, but, yeah, her speech was about how he would accept things, and it was gorgeous on every level. It was, yeah, just a wonderful moment. A little reminiscent of when Heath Ledger's family got up to accept his Oscar. You know, all these posthumous awards really, you know, hit home. But, her speech was absolutely wonderful.
And otherwise, just in the TV categories, the big winners were The Crown in the dramatic categories and Schitt's Creek, unsurprisingly, after its massive Emmy sweep last year, taking it home for the comedies. And I was happy to see John Boyega take an award, a supporting actor award for Small Axe, and boasting about his Balenciagas that he was wearing.
Why not? He's got the microphone.
So let's look forward to the Oscars. The nominations are around the corner. Who are you tipping, and who do you think the dark horses might be?
Yeah, well, it's really hard. See, I'm terrible at tipping because I always say what I want to happen, and that is, you know, very rarely corresponds with how things work out. But except when Parasite won, and that, you know, I think we peaked then. And anyway, look, well, we've sort of touched on the director field. I really hope that the recognition for the films directed extremely well by the female directors of this year, the Regina King, Emerald Fennell, Chloe Zhao. Of course, there are others, but these three are kind of the hot going in award season films. I hope that translates to Oscar. And as I say, Lee Isaac Chung for Minari. Look, I do think that David Fincher will probably still get a nod for Mank, which, yeah, I don't. It's on Netflix. I was so underwhelmed with that film.
It was amusing seeing him taking shots every time he lost an award on the Globes.
It's true. He did embrace the notion of Golden Globes as being the party awards, and he didn't come prepared. Look, good on him. Yeah, I don't fault him for that. I do not understand all the love for Mank, especially for Gary Oldman in the title role, when just the age difference of the two stars. I'm sorry, I need to just get into this quickly. I think they'll probably both get, you know, recognised. Gary Oldman, age 62, plays Herman J. Mankiewicz, scriptwriter of Citizen Kane, and the story is his attempts to write this fantastic screenplay, for which, of course, Orson Welles wanted to claim sole credit, etc. You know, hard drinking, hard living, all of that. Great in theory, but anyway, getting back to my point, Gary Oldman, age 62, is playing Herman J. Mankiewicz, aged 43. Amanda Seyfried, aged 35, is playing Marion Davies, aged 43. They're both playing people the same age. Anyway, my problems with the film don't end with that. But I was so bored, and I love Citizen Kane, and I was fascinated in the writing of it. But it's about an amazing film, but it itself is not an amazing film. Anyway, that said, I'm sure it's going to get Oscar nominations. what do I know? So anyway, and Aaron Sorkin, look, I mean, he'll probably get one for director as well.
Well, I think
for the trial of Chicago 7.
I think you make a good point, because I think that both of those films, Mank and Trial of the Chicago 7, they tick the boxes of what people have an expectation of an Oscar film looks like, and big name directors telling either big moments in history, or even the use of black and white in Mank. I sort of think it's kind of Oscar nomination by algorithm.
Absolutely. And I like to think everyone watches all the screeners. I hope they do, but I'm sure they don't all. And if you
some of them are quite old when we're talking about the Academy. So,
well, they're trying to reinvigorate the membership, so shall we say, and make it more diverse and welcoming, and just a bigger pool from which to draw its nominations. Alas, being a tad cynical about human nature, I'm sure not everyone watches the screeners. And if you see David Fincher film, Aaron Sorkin film on your pile, they're probably going to give it a little love. And, you know, they were nominated for Golden Globes as well. So, look, I reckon they'll get in there as well. On the film front, you know, they can have up to 10. And I think it's been a really strong year, notwithstanding Mank control of Chicago 7, but I think they get in there by default. I'm going to keep saying it. One Night in Miami, Minari, I hope, Promising Young Woman. I don't know, that could be an outlier. I don't know that will absolutely get in there as a best film contender, but Nomadland, I think, is a shoe-in. Like, it's been winning best film all over the place, and that's in cinemas in Australia at the moment, so you can see that. This Chloe Zhao directed, Frances McDormand starring, about nomads in the US, kind of this new, well, it's not new, but about a class of people who live in their vans and go to their job, like travel for work, very solitary lifestyle, you know, living in camper van parks, and a very transitory kind of lifestyle by choice and by circumstance. You know, poverty plays a big role in this too. It's very good, and it's being recognised. So I think that's absolutely going to get a look in. I'd love to see Sound of Metal in there as well, the Riz Ahmed film, which did have a cinema release. It's on one of the streaming platforms. And I think I mentioned it before, but Riz Ahmed plays a drummer who suffers acute hearing loss, and it's him dealing with being hearing impaired and finding that really difficult to adjust to and wanting to get a hearing aid, but living in a community that try and encourage people who find themselves newly deaf to just adjust and just not necessarily try and fix the problem. So it's him grappling with which way he wants to forge his path. It's fantastic. And that would be great to be included. That could be like a little indie that could. I don't know. That's kind of where I hope things go, and two that I expect to go as well.
I mean, it comes down to what the members have seen and what they go for, but also it's clearly very much about who has the marketing power to influence votes. And we've seen that going back to the days that Miramax would throw its weight around and push various films. A number of the titles that we've been talking about, I mean, in the Globe sense, The Crown in TV as well, but Mank and Trial of Chicago 7, Netflix clearly are very good at not necessarily winning, but kind of the way that they push their titles in front of voters.
Yeah. I mean, they also just capture the conversation too, though. So, like, because they have such market power, you know, film Twitter goes nuts when they all drop. Conversely, there's been so little love for Spike Lee's The Five Bloods, which is great, and I would love to see Delroy Lindo get in there for an actor nomination. Sadly, I don't think that's going to happen, but I would love to be pleasantly surprised there. Yeah, he gives it his all in that film, as we discussed in a past episode. But so that's one where the Netflix pool has not been as hopefully I'm wrong, has been enormous as otherwise. But funnily enough, in reading some of the LA Times reporting on the Hollywood Foreign Press debacle, very interesting ad placement for The Five Bloods on those stories in LA Times. So, yeah, especially stories about efforts by the Hollywood Foreign Press, extremely belatedly and I would say a little bit cynically, to try and promise to fix itself. But anyway, interesting to see prominent placement of ads for your consideration for The Five Bloods.
Yeah. It's true. It's just interesting how the changing world, given the pandemic, has sort of reshaped what creates a buzzy movie, because it's not really box office anymore to the extent that was an influencing factor.
Yeah. And streaming services, you know, you don't really know the numbers. You don't know the start times and the completion times even.
No, like,
it's not
at all
a takings kind of a conversation. So it's all buzz.
Yeah. You mentioned Delroy Lindo in terms of a lack of attention. Where do you think in those acting categories the attention's going?
Well, sadly, I think Gary Oldman will get a look in for playing Mank. Look, if nothing else, for trying to be convincing playing a 43-year-old. But I think Chadwick Boseman will follow through from the Golden Globe win for a Best Actor nomination, you know, not least because of a posthumous Oscar acknowledgement. It becomes a career Oscar, really, in these very sad circumstances. So I think definitely he will get a look in. I'd love for Riz Ahmed to be acknowledged for Sound of Metal. Tahar Rahim may for The Mauritanian. This is a Kevin MacDonald film, stars Jodie Foster and Benedict Cumberbatch, and it's, you know, set in Guantanamo Bay, based on a true story of the whole torture and detention and lack of charges. So Tahar Rahim plays Mohamedou Ul-Salahi, a real person detained indefinitely in Guantanamo Bay, and Jodie Foster is his lawyer up against the government, the US government, trying to free him, essentially, or at least have his charges be transparent. So it's a very good kind of potboiler, true political thriller, and just a justice story, really, that's getting a lot of attention. He was nominated for a Golden Globe Award. Jodie Foster won for her supporting role. So I think she'll get a look in for that. And also in the Best Actor, I hope Mads Mikkelsen gets a look in. I think another round will be nominated, not just because he's now a friend of the show. Yeah, I know. I just want the best for Mads, you know. But, it's an excellent role. I would love to see Sacha Baron Cohen recognised for Borat. Not least for the speech. And Steven Yeun would be fantastic for Minari. I fear it may be a smaller performance, the kind of that don't get noticed. I think that would be a real shame, you know. But I am cynical about Oscars too. So, yeah, he may not get in there. But, yeah, look, that's a lot. I don't know if I've exceeded the number of people who can be nominated. I'm just throwing names out there now. Yeah. And in female, I think it's Frances McDormand's to lose. I mean, she tends to win whenever she's nominated, and I can't see why she wouldn't be nominated for Nomadland. Viola Davis, Vanessa Kirby might be for Pieces of a Woman. Yeri Hahn would be great for Minari, but again, it may be not have been noticed enough. Andra Day, who won the Golden Globe.
Yeah, a bit of a surprise.
Think, yeah. I haven't seen that film yet. I need to catch that. So, yeah, I don't know. One thing, Glenn Close has been nominated for Hillbilly Elegy. She famously has never won, but been nominated multiple times. Look, I wish the best for Glenn Close, but I hope it's her win. If she, you know, wouldn't be for that film. It wasn't great. Sorry, friend of the show, Ron Howard. But, yeah, not a great performance, not a great film. Also, Amy Adams, like the two stars who famously always nominated, never winning. Look, will they get nominated this time? Probably. And we can talk if they do. That's another Netflix film.
Mm. Rosamund Pike was the other Golden Globes winner in the comedy category for I Care a Lot.
Yes, I forgot, yeah, which I really enjoyed.
She had a nice gown as well.
She always, you know, rocks up for award shows. Yeah. Well, look, I guess we'll know very soon what my tipping's like. I have my hunches that I'm wrong on a few counts, but yeah. It's a very long award season this year. Oscars aren't till April.
We've gotten all your predictions now recorded. They're sort of down on tape, so...
I'll deny everything.
we can test you when the Oscar nominations come out next week.
Okay.
So let's go to Oprah and a special which had 17 million viewers in the US. In Australia, sort of had something well up over 1.5 million, her conversation with Harry and Meghan. Now, this follows in the footsteps of another couple of high-profile celebrity exposés. We had the investigation by the New York Times, which came out here on Channel 9, framing Britney Spears. And that looked into the situation of her conservatorship, where basically sort of all her personal freedoms and her control over her own business have been legally removed from her. And Alan V. Farrow, an HBO documentary series from Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering that is playing out in Australia on Foxtel and Binge. I guess, you know, to draw a kind of loose parallel between all of them, they are all kind of looking at some kind of, you know, injustice. There's a conversation that I think, you know, I'm keen to have about more broadly true crime, but we can sort of hold that for another time. But, you know, there certainly is a public fascination with these stories. I think in the case of Framing Britney, she obviously wasn't able to participate in the making of that program. Really, she has only been able to speak via either her lawyers or her sort of slightly bizarre Instagram recordings when she puts those out. Alan V. Farrow looks at the long-running child molestation allegations against Woody Allen by his daughter, Dylan Farrow, and it brings some new home video footage that hasn't been previously seen, but doesn't sort of, I guess it's sort of, it's an opportunity for Dylan and Mia Farrow to tell that story. And then in the case of Harry and Meghan, it's really, I mean, what's been causing all the headlines has been the accusations of racism within the royal family, which has led to ultimately Harry and Meghan effectively leaving the royal family and moving to the US. I'm pretty sure you caught the Oprah interview. What did you think?
Yeah, I caught all three. I'm listening how you draw a line between all of them, but they are three very different documentaries. But yes, you're right. Like, injustice is at the heart of all of it, like accusation of racism and, you know, Dylan's insistence that her father molested.
In the public eye, I guess that's sort of the key factor, given that they're such high profile cases.
Yes. No, of course. So what did you, yes, Harry Meghan, of course. Yes, I watched it. And it's fascinating to watch the conversation around it because, of course, that's part of what was at the root of this sense of injustice that Meghan was feeling, all this fueling kind of hatred that I, well, I don't live in Britain and I don't read buy tabloids here, and I guess I don't really see them on newsstands much anymore. But yeah, it shocked me because I thought she, you know, was this whole young royal cool thing having watched the wedding. But yeah, so watching that unfold over recent years to the extent that they had to, you know, leave the country and give up the titles, etc. It was fascinating getting her side of the story. I think she came across as, you know, she presents well and it was believable. I think it's horrendous, the disparity in entitlement that was put to them that they had to put up with for having a child, especially when all of the titles changed. I enjoy that Oprah's interviewing style is being celebrated again because she's a bajillionaire, but extremely relatable in the way she responds to outlandish, you know, revelations.
Those whats were very good. Those shocked whats to the
absolutely.
The questions about colour of a baby's skin.
Yeah, and fair enough. Like, you know, if that was being divulged to me, that'd be 100% my reaction. Hey. What? How can people say that? Yeah, and her body language, of course, has been much memed. Yeah, I thought it was a fascinating interview, especially the first half with just Meghan, but then Harry came in as well. Yeah, I don't know. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, sort of every single word has been dissected multiple times by, you know, media commentators, royal commentators, you know, everyone across the world almost. So, I'm not sure how much more I can add to that. It even led to Piers Morgan ending up quitting Good Morning Britain over sort of this fight with a co-presenter on that show. I think it's sort of interesting just to look at it as television and that the fact that it's been able to command, you know, such a large viewership and the very deliberate decision to embrace free-to-air television as being the home for this special. You know, I think that's interesting in itself, given that Oprah herself is largely off free-to-air television these days. That's obviously where she built up her media empire. But she has moved over to streaming. And I think that it does demonstrate, I guess, for these big breaking stories, that when she does her interviews on a cable channel or on a streaming channel, it just doesn't have the same impact. So as someone who works in broadcast television, that gives me some comfort.
Disclosure, two channels, two free-to-air channels. because those moments were like with – this is where Twitter comes into its own for live, you know, I mean for broadcasts, in that everyone's watching at the same time, everyone – here's the what at the same time. Yeah, I love those kind of moments. Yeah, and I think it does show the value of communal viewing when everyone is apart. You can still have these fantastic moments. Yes, and you mean, like, Harry and Meghan also have deals with Netflix, I think, isn't it? So everyone's got their own streaming deals, but maybe even because of that, they went to a broadcaster for the big sit-down interview.
Yeah, and I guess a big part of the Meghan Markle story is the way that she was treated by the British tabloids and the British press, and the way in which the royal family didn't do enough to defend her and protect her from that. And that is, again, a theme through particularly framing Britney Spears, the level of media attention and kind of almost predatory behaviour by paparazzi and the impacts on her mental health. And obviously sort of Meghan Markle spoke about the impacts on her own mental health in the interview. Sort of perhaps it doesn't feature as heavily in Ellen v. Farrow, but it obviously, the case itself has been the source of pretty much ongoing media speculation and discussion for going on decades now.
Yeah, totally.
A point that's been made is how a lot of that attention was initially all on the relationship with Soon Yi and how that sort of shifted over time. But there's clearly a great public appetite for these kinds of stories. That's what sells the newspapers. That's what drives the paparazzi to be taking these images and you know, and we're talking about paparazzi. Obviously, we know the outcome of what happened with Harry's own mother in the case of that level of scrutiny in her life. And, it obviously led to her
100%.
Death.
100%. And in that moment, there was this reckoning of calls to do better. And here we are again, next generation, literally. Yeah, much the same boat. So
I suppose the question that I feel like I have to ask myself in my fascination in these subjects, these three programs are obviously very sort of sympathetic to the subjects that they're talking about.
Yeah.
But in itself, are they just further fueling this sort of tabloid public interest, despite the fact that they're trying to present the viewpoint of these people that have been victims of this level of invasion of privacy? Are they doing anything to correct that, or are they really just contributing to it, even to a greater degree?
Yeah. Well, of course, the fact that we're talking about all three as well, like it's they are the Oprah moment, of course, and, Piers Morgan, perhaps a happy outcome will be he's less, but God knows where he'll end up. But anyway, yes, of course they're talked about moments. Of course when Oprah sits down for the tell-all interview, it's only going to fuel more things. But also, to what extent are they responsible for how that's going to be treated? Like it's, to Megan's point, it was, shock and dismay at the lack of wanting to set the record straight. And the hypocrisy, there was another royal sit-down interview that was a complete train wreck that didn't get anywhere near this much scrutiny that should have. Prince Andrew is no stranger to controversy, and that's not been anywhere near as, much of a call that it might bring down the monarchy. So that's an interesting, I think, feeds Meghan's point, really, that they're being treated differently. Mm.
Yeah, that's
that
a
didn't
good
answer
point.
Question. I just made it a segue.
But I agree that those figures in the public eye, there is a great desire, given all the noise that's generated around, what's happening in your own life. And you are ultimately a human being with, kind of that's been put in this pressure cooker environment. And it obviously makes a lot of sense why someone in that environment would wish to try and find a sympathetic outlet that will tell the story that the way that they wish it to be told. And I think that we're seeing some examples of that.
Yeah, so that whole idea of the power of celebrity in these moments of crisis.
Yeah, yeah. So if you haven't caught these, there, a lot of people have been watching them. You very well may have already seen them, but Oprah with Harry and Meghan is out now on 10Play in Australia and CBS in the US. Alan V. Farrow is out on HBO or Binge and Foxtel in Australia. And Framing Britney Spears is out now on Hulu in the US or 9Now in Australia. I don't know how many US listeners we have, but we just want to take care of them.
All right. Well, that's a lot of what we've been watching. But we do have a segment that we like to call What We've Been Watching, where we just single out something that surprise we've been watching. Ben, what have you been watching?
Well, I think you and I have both been watching WandaVision.
Yes.
Which is out now on Disney Plus, but it certainly is part of the MCU or the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Why don't we take a listen to the trailer?
It's twilight time.
Wanda and Vision, aren't we a five pair?
This is our home now. I want us to fit in.
Oh, this is gonna be a gas!
Where did you two move from? How long have you been married, and why don't you have children yet?
Our story.
I think what my wife means to say is that we moved from...
Moved from where? Married when? Damn it, why?
Oh, Arthur, stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it.
Like days of old, lighting the spark of love that
fills me with the rain of love. Am I dead?
No. Why would you think that?
Because you are.
Each day I pray for evening. No, so Sophie, I think you and I might be coming at this from two different perspectives, in that I don't think that you're a big Marvel consumer, whereas I think I've seen everything that that's been released in the MCU. But this is quite a departure. I think sort of what's interesting about this, so through, you know, these different phases of Marvel, they sort of moved through different storylines. The Endgame movie was, you know, one of the biggest box office hits of all time, kind of saw death of a major character, kind of wrapped up. Yeah, like wrapped up a sort of significant part of the storyline. And then this move into Disney Plus was intended to kick off with Falcon and Winter Soldier, which launches in March. And by the looks of things, is a pretty straightforward sort of buddy action adventure. But that was delayed because of COVID. So WandaVision was the first taste we had of this foray into television. And we ended up with the first couple of episodes being in black and white in the style of a sitcom, which I don't know what anyone, you know, quite expected.
Mm-hmm. Least of all me. And that got me immediately because it was nothing like the Marvel films I have seen. Like, I've seen quite a lot of them, but, yeah, I'm a little cynical that these incredible stories about superhuman feats and powers typically end up with two guys punching each other in the end. And, look, I'd take a 1-2 miss a few approach, so I'm not fully across who is who, and when a character comes back, I don't always know who they are, etc. That's it. But WandaVision, yes, picks up from two major characters in The Avengers, Wanda Maximoff and The Vision.
Yep, played by Elizabeth Olsen and Paul Bettany.
Yeah, and I mean, this has to be a spoiler, really, that Vision is dead, but he's in WandaVision, the show, which is the show within a show. Yes, because as you say, that it starts with a very stylized 50s sitcom, moving to a stylized 60s sitcom, 70s, etc. So each week takes a decade and adopts the look and the costumes and the theme songs of all of the famous sitcoms of the era and buys into the tropes in a really effective way, to the extent that I would 100% watch a show with superheroes. I mean, it's Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie. I 100% make those shows. But there was much, 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 much more going on in WandaVision that at first you had no idea what was going on, but they're drip feeding each week with little teasers at the end credits, of course, because it's Marvel, culminated in an incredible TV experience, which I absolutely adored. What about you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that there's sort of been some back and forth commentary about, was it the right approach to be dropping these episodes on a weekly basis versus the kind of full season drop Netflix approach? And I think it has good and bad aspects in that certainly it very much motivated the fan base and those who were watching to speculate about the mysteries in the show. And I think it's a show that is built on a mystery of, you know, why are we dropped into this world that we're in and why are we seeing it told this way? And fortunately, it doesn't completely rise or fall on that revelation. I think when the revelation comes, I mean, I think it works in terms of the characters, but I think that the show has more to offer than just the twist reveal. But it certainly meant that a lot of viewers were sort of spending a lot of time in between episodes speculating on what the twist reveals might be. Whether or not you go in cold and you don't know this or not, or you've come from the previous films, Wanda and Vision were in a relationship. Vision was murdered. For the first scene in the first episode of this, it's in black and white, it's the 1950s, and they're driving up to this house sort of with a kind of just married sign on their car. And so suddenly he's back and they're starting this relationship together and they both don't quite know what's going on. One thing that was so great about this show is just how beautifully observed and affectionate the tributes to each era of television were. And, you know, by the time we got up to the 90s and sort of Malcolm in the Middle and references, then the noughties and Modern Family, and it was pitch perfect in the way that these shows were recreated for what was really a story about grief and immense grief.
Absolutely, yeah. They meticulously recreate the eras they are depicting each week on screen, hilariously so, but reverentially and with some commercials. Yeah, it's about a love of television, which is also comes to be part of the storyline. And yeah, the underlying mystery, as you say, it doesn't spoil it to find out what that is. It actually, yeah, I found it really profound, and I loved the second last episode to me that was just stunning about grief and coping and, yeah, what it does to you. Yeah, I absolutely loved this show, and I confess I was a bit cynical in putting on a Marvel show. I've spent a long time in cinemas watching the films, and, yeah, we, you know, some were great, but largely I don't buy into the universe. But it was incredible. And Elizabeth Olsen, you know, come award season, I hope it's getting a lot of love. Paul Bettany, you know, Catherine Hahn plays Agatha, a neighbour. She's certainly really getting terrific. Her time in the sun. She's been absolutely, yeah, just the detail to which this has all been created. I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
I think what's very clever is in trying to scale down a big blockbuster movie experience to a small screen experience, you know, obviously comes with challenges. And I think what will be interesting for Marvel fans is whether Falcon and Winter Soldier, which I mentioned, does that successfully by sort of in a way trying to recreate the cinema experience on your television, whereas this didn't try and do that. And I think that's what was the very clever creative choice that they made, is they said, well, how do we tell this story on a television? Well, let's make that the story.
100%, yeah.
I think sort of that was a very wise move. And then the other thing about it is comic books, obviously, by their very nature, are serial. And all these Marvel stories are all about the sequels and the what's coming next. And this storyline will bleed into other stories. But I don't think there will be another season of WandaVision. It is its own self-contained story. Because, you know, how could you tell this again? I don't think you can. But I think that the creators knew that. And so they've just created a sort of bubble or hex to kind of tell the story within, and I think that works really well. I think that, you know, that some of the tropes obviously show through. There's villains revealed. If you think you're going to get through a Marvel series without having superpowered entities, you know, battling each other in the skies, you're going to get battling each other in the skies with special effects. It's going to happen.
Oh, totally. There is two guys punching each other in the finale there.
Yeah. There has been some talk about, did the show try and oversell our sympathy for Wanda in the final episode in relation to kind of what she did out of her sense of grief to others? And I think that there are some relevant points there. But but no, I think, I mean, like you, I think that second last episode, which is sort of stepping through her sort of memories, basically, just was a very, just very well observed reflection on what it is to lose people close to you and what that means.
Yep. And like you mentioned the weekly drop and how people are a little resistant to that because like the instant gratification that we all want to, when you want to binge something and you're made to wait for it. I think it benefits, like, as you say, the conversation and the speculation. It's in the best interest of the show to keep the conversation running. I was really disappointed by some feedback about people concerned that certain episodes didn't drive the story forward enough, because I don't think that was what this was about. Like, it was all character. It's about Wanda and how you rebuild yourself when you've lost everything that you hold dear. I think, yeah, that was amazing. I don't think if you, like, there's plot, of course, but that's not what takes precedence here.
Yeah. And I think there's a theme around the way in which we construct fantasy, which obviously all these sort of comic book adaptations do to varying degrees of success, but the way that we construct fantasy in order to give our lives meaning. And I think that's what this really nailed.
Well said.
So that was WandaVision, which we both very much enjoyed, and it's out everywhere in the world on Disney Plus.
And you can binge it because they're all up there now.
That's right. And I think that's it for our show for the week. Please make sure you subscribe to SBS The Playlist wherever you get your podcasts, and give us a lot of stars and leave us a nice review, because it helps people find us. And you can let us know what you thought of the movies and TV shows we discussed on Facebook or Twitter at SBS Movies, and give us your Oscar predictions. And I'm on Twitter at Ben Nguyen TV.
And I'm on Twitter at Anything But Fifi.
And The Playlist is produced by Jeremy Wilmot. Until next time.
Thanks for listening.